This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Peltz. Indian authorities have launched a search operation after part of a Himalayan glacier broke, killing at least 9 people and leaving 140 missing. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett reports.
The flood was caused when a portion of Nanda Devi Glacier broke off in northern India. A video shared by officials shows a wall of water surging into a local dam and breaking it into pieces before roaring downstream. 2 hydropower plants and 2 separate rivers were destroyed. Officials say 12 workers have been rescued, but more than 100 are still missing. They also immediately alerted residents living in the area and evacuated them to safer places. I'm Sarah Bassett.
Thousands and thousands of people rallied for a second day across Myanmar Sunday, denouncing last week's coup. Protesters are also demanding the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi in the biggest protest since the 2007 Saffron Revolution that helped lead to democratic reforms. On Sunday afternoon, the junta ended a day-long blockade of the internet that had further inflamed anger since the coup last Monday. There was no comment from the junta, and state-run television news carried no mention of the protests. 12 members of Somalia's security forces were killed and 2 others wounded on Sunday, the deaths following a powerful roadside explosion in the central state of Galmudug, according to officials. The attack occurred near the village of El Dere, 28 kilometers west of Dusa Mareb, during a security operation, according to those officials. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility for the attack. More stories on voanews.com. This is VOA News. Speaking Sunday in an interview with media network CNN, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said American workers who earn $60,000 per year should receive stimulus checks as part of the White House's proposed coronavirus relief package. The White House has said it is open to negotiation on who should be eligible to receive the proposed $1,400 checks and has declined to specify where it thinks the income cutoff should be. If Congress approves the $1.9 trillion plan, Yellen said the country would get back to full employment next year. Otherwise, she said, unemployment would linger for years. Republicans on Capitol Hill have resisted the administration's COVID-19 relief plan, concerned it would unnecessarily increase the national debt following the $4 trillion aid package that Congress passed last year. The U.S. Senate will soon have to decide whether to convict former President Donald Trump for incitement of insurrection. The former president's impeachment trial begins on Tuesday, the first for a president who is no longer in office. Senators will sit at their desks and listen to hours of testimony about the violent mob of Trump supporters who laid siege to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. The House impeached President Trump on January 13th, 1 week after the violence. Republicans and President Trump's lawyers argue that the trial is unnecessary and even unconstitutional because he is no longer president and cannot be removed from office. While his acquittal is expected, all 100 senators will first have to sit at their desks and listen to hours of graphic testimony from House Democrats about the riots, which left 5 people dead. Ecuadorians choose a new president on Sunday. Many voters are weary of painful economic austerity measures and eager for a return to socialism, encouraging left-wing candidate Andres Arauz, who hopes to win without needing a runoff vote. The 36-year-old economist, a protege of former President Rafael Correa, leads in polls on promises to make $1 billion in direct cash payments to families. His main rival, Guillermo Lasso, has been hurt by his image as a conservative banker, and pollsters say the possibility of low voter turnout due to the pandemic could dent his support. Lawyer and indigenous activist Yaku Perez is third in the polls. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
The This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. President Joe Biden proposes a sweeping immigration reform agenda, but will it garner sufficient bipartisan support? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On his first day in office, President Biden signed a flurry of executive orders reversing former President Trump's restrictions on immigration. With the stroke of a pen, Mr. Biden ended travel restrictions from predominantly Muslim countries in the Middle East and Africa, initiated a halt to border wall funding, and strengthened protections for the so-called Dreamers, or immigrants brought to the country illegally as children. He is calling on Congress to pass legislation which provides Dreamers permanent legal status and a path to citizenship. This would essentially cement the protections in the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, which protected the Dreamers from deportation. Another element of President Biden's immigration reform bill, called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, which aims to overhaul the nation's broken immigration system more permanently, is a pathway to legal status for nearly 11 million immigrants currently in the country illegally. The bill would also address the root causes of migration, especially from Central America. As reported by U.S. News and World Report, the bill would create a $4 billion plan to tackle the underlying factors that cause people to migrate to the United States, especially from the so-called Northern Triangle countries, or Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. The legislation also calls for increased border security by providing funding for screening and enforcement technology and training for border agents. U.S. News and World Report staff writer Claire Hansen also states that, quote, though ambitious, the bill is not without precedent. In 2013, during the Obama administration, the Democratic-led Senate easily passed a bipartisan immigration reform measure that would have cleared a path to citizenship for immigrants in the country illegally and made major changes to the legal immigration system, unquote. She notes, however, that the bill was not picked up by the Republican-controlled House and died. Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush, identified the issue as a priority and backed measures that included both a path to citizenship and heightened border security to no avail. Even though the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the executive branch are currently controlled by Democrats, it is a narrow majority, especially in the Senate, which is evenly divided 50-50. Democrats would need to sway 10 Republicans to overcome procedural hurdles required to approve any major legislation. Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida and one of the so-called Gang of Eight who worked on the 2013 measure called the Biden bill a non-starter. Well, for more on the substance and politics of President Biden's immigration reform proposal, we turn to two immigration analysts. Ali Norani is president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum, and that's a nonpartisan advocacy organization working with faith, law enforcement, and business leaders to promote the value of immigrants and immigration. And Laura Reese, she's a senior research fellow in Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a conservative think tank here in Washington. Previously, Laura worked at the Department of Homeland Security on management and immigration policy and operations issues. And both join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Carol.
Ali Norani, let me begin with you. What is your assessment of President Biden's immigration proposal? Are you largely in favor or against, and why?
Well, I think that the Biden administration's proposal, as we understand it, is a balanced approach to migration in the 21st century by really thinking about what are the root causes of why somebody needs to migrate to the U.S. I think that's a very important starting point to up the investment in Central America so that there's a reduction in corruption, violence, impunity, poverty. And these are the factors that ultimately lead somebody to make a perfectly natural decision to say, you know what, I'm going to try to find safety somewhere else. Second, I would say that their approach to border security is very, very informed. There is a lot of language in the proposal as it stands to think about what are the most effective border enforcement policies. What are the ones that will keep the country safe from the smuggling of people, of drugs, of guns, of money? In fact, for the Biden administration to think so specifically about investing in ports of entry, where the majority of drugs, guns, and money are smuggled, I think is just smart border enforcement, which has frankly been missing for a very, very long time in the country. And then third, to really think about how do we make sure that the undocumented immigrant community is brought into the full light of our society as taxpayers, as contributors. And if they do meet certain criteria and pass criminal background checks after a number of years, to fully own the American dream as U.S. citizens. So overall, this is, I think, a very positive and encouraging starting point. And now we turn to Congress to really develop the bipartisan support that we know that exists for ideas like this.
Turning to you, Laura Reese, for your take on the Biden immigration proposal. Whether you're for or against it, do you see it as a positive start or do you see some drawbacks?
Definitely see some drawbacks. In terms of the proposed legislation that has gone to Congress, it does not appear to include any border security provisions. And in the multiple comprehensive immigration reform bills that have been debated in Congress the past two decades, they always included border security provisions. In addition, it attempts to erase the line between legal and illegal immigration, including changing the word alien to non-citizen. What this does is overshadows the difference between someone who comes here unlawfully, what happens to people who come here as visitors temporarily, and then, in addition, we have a third category of lawful permanent residents. To change the word alien to non-citizen groups all three of those categories into one. Furthermore, it increases competition for American workers who are struggling right now with unemployment and the economic fallout from COVID and forced shutdowns by the government, and would greatly increase costs to the taxpayer. On the executive order front, the president seems to be prioritizing illegal immigrants over lawful immigrants and over U.S. citizens. He is greatly reducing the amount of immigration enforcement and really narrowing the priorities of who would be removed. And also, you had mentioned revoking the travel restrictions. That has been grossly mischaracterized as being about Muslim and religious and nationality purposes under the Trump administration, when great detail and a very thorough review was done by the Trump administration for nearly 200 countries to determine who cooperated with the U.S. with basic international travel requirements, who is a state sponsor of terrorism, who protects terrorists among their country. And to revoke those travel restrictions is a real danger to our national security.
Turning back to you, Ali Noorani, I do want to move on, but I'd like to give you a chance to respond to Laura's critique of the Biden proposal, as well as some of those executive orders to which she referred.
So I think one of the things that we have to be really clear about is that job number one for the Biden administration, for Republicans and Democrats, is to get the country back on its feet as we struggle to respond and recover from COVID-19. I think Laura and I would completely agree on that. Now, when you look at the data and really who's been working shoulder to shoulder with U.S. citizens to get us through COVID-19, it's the immigrant community. 70% of farm workers are immigrant. 40% of food packers are immigrant. And when you look at the farm working community, some estimates have up to 3/4 of farm workers are undocumented immigrants. And these are folks who are here, they're working, they're quite literally getting food to our table. So I think that the Biden plan is a smart and compassionate acknowledgement of what the U.S. citizen worker and their families need in terms of getting food to their table. So let's make sure that those farm workers who are by and large undocumented are able to be American and contribute fully as taxpayers to our society. And then, you know, the questions around kind of the executive orders, I think that the Biden administration has really tried to balance what's the message we're sending to the world with the health challenges that we continue to face. So, you know, when you look closely at the executive orders that have been signed, you know, many kind of COVID-19 related travel restrictions stay in place. In fact, those were held over from the Trump administration. But there's really no national intelligence reason or homeland security reason to retain the Muslim and African travel bans that the Trump administration put into place. Elizabeth Newman, in fact, who was an assistant secretary for the Department of Homeland Security for President Trump, recently wrote a report making that precise case that there is no national security reason to continue those travel bans. So I think that there are positive things moving forward that ultimately serve the needs of the American worker and their families.
One more question, Ali, before I go back to Laura, and that is, Laura talked about the fact that she doesn't think that there's enough for border security. And in fact, there are funds for technology to screen people and cargo at the border, but really no physical barriers. Do you see that as a problem?
I don't see that as a problem at all. Do you remember El Chapo, the very kind of notorious drug smuggler from Mexico? Well, when he was on trial in the U.S., his lieutenants said, under oath, that they were not worried about structures in between ports of entry. Where they wanted to get their drugs into the U.S. was through ports of entry. So this is the mastermind of drug smuggling that has decimated families across the United States. So if he is saying, you know what, your ports of entry are kind of pretty weak, that's where our priority should be. So I think that the Biden administration, the Department of Homeland Security, let's think about where the risks are and improve our security at those risk points. And that's ports of entry. And, you know, this proposal, you know, I'm looking at a draft of it right now, and it's pretty clear that, you know, there's a priority on risk-based border enforcement, not symbolic walls in the middle of deserts where there are no significant risks to the public safety of the American people.
Turning back to you, Laura Reese. You obviously have different views on this very controversial issue, but what about the so-called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, minors who were brought to the United States illegally as children who really know no other country than the United States? Would you agree that there should be a pathway to green cards, that is permanent resident status and citizenship for them?
No, I would not agree with that. That is a form of amnesty. And the U.S. has a set of immigration laws. We have a right, like every other sovereign nation, to enforce those immigration laws. And while we are a nation that continues to have the most generous immigration policy in the world, we immigrate more than 1 million people lawfully each year. Secondly, it's about valuing human life. Parents are making the very dangerous journey north and bringing their children with them, not only risking themselves, their lives to smugglers, to drug cartels, human trafficking, etc., but then they are here unlawfully and face the circumstances that they do. Parents need to do this lawfully, and the government should encourage migrants to follow our immigration laws and to do it lawfully. To award lawbreaking with green cards is a smack in the face to the many millions over the decades who have followed the law, waited their turn, and are proud to come to America following its laws. So no, I do not agree that rewarding illegal immigration with green cards is good policy, because we never end this cycle.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Ali Noorani, president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum, and that's a nonpartisan advocacy organization that works with faith, law enforcement, and business leaders to promote the value of immigrants and immigration, and Laura Reese. She's Senior Research Fellow in Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation. And we are discussing the pros and cons of President Joe Biden's immigration reform proposal. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Afghanistan, Miran Warsha Amiri. As always, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, now back to our discussion on immigration reform in the United States
And back to you, Ali Noorani. I don't want to belabor the point on the DACA, but just to give you an opportunity to respond to what Laura Reese was saying about the DACA program, that if they are given a pathway to citizenship, that this sends a signal to others that they can bring children illegally to the country. What do you say to those who think this is the wrong message?
Well, you know, again, I just go back to the data and the challenges that are facing the country right now as we are trying to respond and recover to COVID-19. And the data shows that 29,000 DACA recipients are healthcare professionals. I've talked to a number of them who are in fact healthcare professionals in rural, underserved communities across the country that are quite literally helping Americans and their families respond and recover to COVID-19. So I think that DACA recipients across the country, whether they are healthcare professionals, food service workers, engineers, or otherwise, they're contributing to the bottom line interests of the United States. I just think that we've got to be rational about their approach here. And in fact, you know, Laura brings up a really interesting point, is that if there's anything that I would quibble with in terms of the Biden immigration proposal, is that we really need to be thinking about the future of our legal immigration system. And one of the most effective ways to mitigate and reduce undocumented or unauthorized immigration is to actually have a functioning legal immigration system that creates the pathways for whether they're workers or families to enter the country in a regulated fashion. That's something that I think Republicans have the opportunity to bring to the table in Congress, and I think ultimately will reduce significantly unauthorized migration to the U.S.
Quick point of fact, Ali, is the DACA proposal part of the overall U.S. reform legislation that Biden has proposed, or is that separate from it?
The U.S. Citizenship Act, as proposed by President Biden, would, for both DACA recipients and farm workers, because remember, farm workers are playing such a significant role in the response and recovery to COVID-19. For both of those communities, they would be able to move from their current status to legal permanent residence, and then after they've met the criteria as LPRs, be able to apply for citizenship.
Thanks. Ali Noorani, let's talk about the politics, because clearly this is the biggest challenge. How do you see moving this legislation forward, given the criticisms that Laura Reese has expressed, which really echo many of the Republican critiques about this bill? Do you think there's any chance, or could the bill be broken up, like the part about DACA? They maybe can pass that, but they can't pass the whole thing. How do you see the politics of this immigration bill?
Well, I think one of the things that was missing during the Obama administration is that we were never clear exactly what the Obama administration wanted to see in terms of legislation. So we've got that from the Biden camp, if you will. Now, I think it's up to House and Senate leaders to really determine what can the legislative market bear in Congress. And I think one scenario is that we see a handful of different pieces of legislation, let's say a DREAM Act to serve DACA recipients and Dreamers, something to address the approximately 400,000 to 500,000 recipients of temporary protected status, many of those folks who have been here on temporary legal status for up to 20 years. And then for farm workers to legalize their status and to establish a functional legal immigration process for farm workers. In fact, all three of those components moved through the House of Representatives last year. They can move before April as they stand now. And then the process really focuses on the Senate. And in the Senate, we need to identify the 10 Republicans who want to be a part of a constructive approach. And remember, immigration reform for decades has always enjoyed bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. So, you know, we're confident that we're going to be able to get to the necessary 60 votes because we know that this is what the American public is looking for.
Turning back to you, Laura Reese, Ali Noorani responded to your critique about the DACA program, this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, saying that, you know, in fact, these were minors who came here illegally as children, and that they really do make a strong contribution to the country. And he also mentioned the farm workers and those under temporary protected status, which are part of the larger Biden immigration reform agenda. To what extent do you think that perhaps DACA could be a point of convergence between Democrats and Republicans?
Well, again, to award the lawbreaking with green cards here sends the wrong message, and this cycle then would continue. With respect to temporary protected status, That program has become anything but temporary. And the original intent of the program, which was to protect people who happened to be in the U.S. when something bad happened in their home country, whether it was a natural disaster or civil strife breaking out, has become more of a group asylum and even a group amnesty. And that was not the intent at all. In terms of the agricultural workers, we do have lawful programs, worker programs, whether it is agricultural worker program or seasonal non-agricultural worker programs. And those have been rather successful, particularly during the COVID time. Reforming those, we can debate that, negotiate that, make those programs better. But that is the point. It's to make the lawful programs work for Americans and for American employers, and to limit and greatly reduce illegal immigration to the U.S.
So back to you, Ali Noorani. In terms of public opinion, where does public opinion stand with respect to immigration reform? And how much will that matter for Congress? And to what extent do you think some Republicans who are reluctant to go forward and are more inclined to adhere to the Trump policy of more restriction, to what extent could that move some Republicans?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because actually over the course of the Trump administration, we saw public support for immigration increase over time. But I've always been kind of one of the, I think, few advocates out here who says, okay, public opinion is one thing, but what's reality? And, you know, reality for Republican members of Congress, particularly House members and, you know, a third of the Senate every year, is that they're going to have to face a primary election in 2022. So what I keep going back to is the 2018 midterm election and then even 2020, because in both of those elections, you saw growing numbers of conservative voters in suburban and even rural areas who are saying two things. They are still people of faith, but they no longer self-identify as evangelical. That's number one. And number two, you see that both in 2018 and in 2020, they were turned off by President Trump's child separation policy, the travel ban, and many of the other harsh enforcement measures that the Trump administration put into place. And they're looking for a different path forward on immigration. Wherein lies the opportunity for Democrats and obviously President Biden to be speaking to this electorate who used to vote Republican? They're now looking for either a Republican to think about immigration differently or Democrats who are going to really represent the values that they seek.
Turning back to you, Laura Reese, what about the politics of the legislation? Do you see any potential compromise between Democrats and Republicans on this bill?
So I agree with your point that you raised before about doing single issue bills. Congress has not seemed to learn from its own past of creating hundreds and hundreds of pages, even 1,000-page comprehensive immigration reform bills that then die of their own weight. And unfortunately, members of Congress have not allowed single issue bills. If for example, a mandatory E-Verify bill is introduced, opponents of that don't let that bill move unless they attach something that they want, such as an amnesty, and it just grows from there. And they have repeated this over the past two decades. I do think they would be more successful if they took an approach of single issue bills.
And then lastly, Laura Reese, in terms of public opinion, it seems like public opinion is moving toward a reform of our immigration system. What is your reading of public opinion?
Americans want to continue to have border security. So to have a bill that would have no border security as part of it, I think, is a non-starter. To stop building the wall is the opposite of doing national security. Border patrol agents have requested the wall. They say it works where it is built, and it makes their jobs easier, and it stops poisonous drugs that flow between the ports. Americans want good jobs. They want economic opportunity. And again, in this COVID economy and high unemployment, it does not make sense to add further competition from people who aren't here lawfully when Americans are trying to get back to work and get their feet back on the ground. And Americans want to be safe. So that means having sound immigration vetting, but also not encouraging people to make the dangerous illegal journey north to the U.S., putting themselves at danger and enriching corrupt smugglers and drug cartels.
Well, certainly immigration reform, a very controversial issue, and I'm sure we'll be returning to that in the near future. That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ali Noorani, President and CEO of the National Immigration Forum, and Laura Reese, Senior Research Fellow in Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
To Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dan Friedel brings us the Education Report. He will talk about the U.S. Justice Department dropping a lawsuit against a well-known university. Then we will hear from Susan Shand. She brings us a story from Britain's vaccine chief. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will end with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. And now, here is the Education Report.
The U.S. Department of Justice withdrew a lawsuit last week against Yale University over how it accepts students. In October 2020, the department accused the school in New Haven, Connecticut, of making it too hard for Asian American and white American students to be accepted. The lawsuit said Yale uses race as a determinative factor in hundreds of admissions decisions each year. That term means race was considered a main reason for accepting or denying students. The case resulted from a legal action brought in 2016 by the Asian American Coalition for Education. The organization condemned the Justice Department's sudden move on Wednesday, calling the dismissal baseless. Colleges and universities in the U.S. say they make an effort to seek out and admit qualified students from different backgrounds. The decisions are not based on grades and test scores alone. That means they consider where a student is from, what kind of high school they attended, and what kind of experiences they had in life before college. These considerations include the student's race and citizenship.
At famous colleges like the Ivy League schools in the northeastern U.S., there is still a relatively low percentage of Black students. The Ivy League includes Harvard University in Massachusetts, Yale University in Connecticut, and Princeton University in New Jersey. Cases that have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court helped universities update how they make their admissions decisions. The policy that permits universities to give extra weight to the race of an applicant when making their decision is called affirmative action. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled several times that colleges can consider race as a way to accept students with different backgrounds. However, some groups of students have disputed affirmative action policies. They say famous universities are preventing qualified Asian American and white students from being accepted.
In the Yale case, Asian American students said they were not being treated in a fair way. And in a statement last August, the Department of Justice said Asian American and white students had only 1/10 to 1/4 of the likelihood of admission when compared to similar black students. Yale rejected this. The university's president said it would not change its admissions policies. With the recent ruling, it will not have to change. A spokeswoman called the Justice Department's decision gratifying. Swan Lee is a co-founder of the Asian American Coalition for Education. She was angry about the decision. "It's a setback in our fight against racial discrimination against Asian Americans in education," she said.
Some civil rights groups say the Department of Justice's recent decision was a good one. David Hinojosa is director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He said the decision fits with past court decisions that said admissions decisions that consider race are legal. Black students and other students of color who come from all walks of life can rest a little easier knowing our government is looking to lift them up, not divide and suppress, he said. While the case against Yale will not move forward with the support of the U.S. government, the case against Harvard will likely continue. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
Now, let's hear from Susan Shand.
The head of Britain's vaccination deployment effort says the world faces around 4,000 variants of the virus that causes COVID-19. As a result of new mutated versions, vaccine manufacturers are looking for ways to improve the shots to resist the virus variants. Vaccine Deployment Minister Nadeem Zahawi said Thursday. British researchers plan to test a mix of two vaccines, the Pfizer-BioNTech and Oxford-AstraZeneca injections, to see if the two together can create stronger immunity. Experts say thousands of individual changes arise as the virus mutates and develops into new variants over time. However, only a small number of mutations are likely to change the virus in an important way, the British Medical Journal reports. So far, the most concerning versions identified by scientists are the so-called British, South African, and Brazilian variants, which appear to spread more quickly than others. Zahawi said it was likely that the vaccines available now will be effective against the new virus variants. "It's very unlikely that the current vaccine won't be effective on the variants, especially when it comes to severe illness and hospitalization," Zahawi told Britain's Sky News. He said major vaccine manufacturers are working on ways to make sure that we are ready for any variant, adding that there are about 4,000 variants around the world of COVID now. "We are keeping a library of all the variants so that we are ready to respond to any challenge that the virus may present and produce the next vaccine," Zahawi said. The coronavirus has killed 2.2 million people worldwide since it was found in China in late 2019, Johns Hopkins University of Medicine reports. Israel leads the world in effectively vaccinating its citizens. It is followed by the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, Bahrain, the United States, and then Spain, Italy, and Germany. Britain has begun a trial to consider the immune response that comes from using the vaccines from both Pfizer and AstraZeneca in two injections. Results of the trial are expected in June. The trial will combine an mRNA injection, such as the one developed by Pfizer and BioNTech, and an adenovirus viral vector vaccine developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca. Viral vector vaccines carry genes that prepare the body to fight against COVID-19. Russia's Sputnik V is also a viral vector vaccine. In a separate trial, it is being tested in combination with AstraZeneca's vaccine. The British researchers said there are two main advantages to vaccinating people with two different vaccine versions. It may increase immune responses, and it would give governments more ways to get the vaccines out to their populations. Matthew Snape is an Oxford vaccine expert who is leading the trial. He told reporters that using different vaccine injections had proven to be effective in fighting Ebola. He added that scientists believe the new combinations will create a good immune response. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language a little more closely. Often, our expressions come from everyday objects. Today, we talk about a candle. Sometimes we use candles to create a feeling of calm or some other sort of feeling. We call that an ambiance. For example, dinner by candlelight is a lot more romantic than dinner under fluorescent lights. Often candles smell nice too. We can buy our favorite scents or kinds of smells. This makes them even more calming. But candles are useful as well. If the electricity goes out, candles can light a dark night. In the days before electricity, candles were a main source of light for work. And that brings us to today's expression, to burn the candle at both ends. This expression is used several ways. Usually it means that we are busy with work, but not always. Let's say I spent all of last year working on two very important goals at the same time. Friends could say that I burned my candle at both ends for a whole year. Finally, I got burned out, which means I was really tired. If we use up all of our energy by leading a busy life with work, friends, and seemingly endless activities, we can say we are burning the candle at both ends. We are busy from early morning until late at night. Here is another example. Ever since starting a new job and getting her master's degree, my friend Annette has been burning the candle at both ends.
She has been doing a lot. The expression also appears in creative forms of writing. In her poem, Figs from Thistles, First Fig, poet Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote about it this way.
My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light.
Now let's hear how these two friends use the expression in this short exchange.
Where have you been? I haven't talked to you in weeks.
I know. Sorry about that. I got a book deal last month, so I've been kind of busy with that.
Congratulations. But I thought you were still in school.
I am. That's why I've been burning the candle at both ends for the past... What month is it?
It's February. Wow, you have been busy.
At VOA Learning English, we work really hard to bring you informative programs. Sometimes we even burn the candle at both ends to get the job done. Thankfully, though, not every week. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The stock market crash of 1929 began a long and difficult period for the United States. President Herbert Hoover struggled to find solutions as the nation sank into the worst economic crisis in its history. But the Great Depression was not the only problem demanding answers from Hoover. The president also had to deal with a number of foreign policy issues. I'm Mario Ritter with Chris Cruz. We look at how the Great Depression affected relations between the United States and other countries.
My mother told me, away, said, son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray, 'cause there'll be hard times, hard times. Oh yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I?
There were revolutions in South America. Japan launched a campaign of aggression in northeastern China, and the economic situation in America created serious problems in relations with Europe. Hoover succeeded in some areas of his foreign policy, but he failed to solve America's economic troubles. And, like most Americans, he failed to recognize the importance of political changes taking place in Japan and Germany.
Herbert Hoover's foreign policy was marked by his desire to make friends and avoid war. Like most Americans, the new president had been shocked by World War I. Hoover had seen the results of that terrible war with his own eyes. He led the international effort to feed the many European victims of the fighting. The new president was also a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends. Quakers oppose war. Hoover shared the wish of most Americans that the world would never again fight a major war. To him, the bloody bodies at Verdun, the Marne, and the other battlefields of World War I showed the need to seek peace through negotiations.
Hoover worked toward this goal even before he entered the White House. Following his election, he had several months before becoming president. Hoover used this time to travel to Latin America for 10 weeks. He wanted to show Latin American nations that they could trust the United States to honor their rights as independent nations. Hoover kept his word. The year after he took office, his administration announced that it would recognize the governments of all Latin American countries, including governments that the United States did not like. Hoover told the American people that he would not follow the Latin American policies of President Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt decided in 1904 that the United States had a right to intervene in Latin America if it disagreed with the actions of governments there. Hoover said this was wrong. He told the country that it was more important to use friendship than to use force.
Hoover withdrew American forces from Nicaragua. He also arranged to withdraw them from Haiti. And he showed restraint as some 50 revolutions shook the nations of Latin America. Some revolutionary governments opposed the United States. They refused to pay debts to American companies, or they claimed ownership of foreign property. But Hoover refused to advance American interests by force. He wanted to prove that the United States could treat Latin American nations as equals. That policy was quite successful. Relations between the United States and Latin American countries generally improved under Herbert Hoover's leadership.
The situation in Europe was much more difficult and much more serious for the United States. The problem was simple: money. The Great Depression did not stop at America's borders. It moved to Britain, Europe, and beyond. And it brought extremely hard economic conditions. In Germany, the value of the national currency collapsed. Inflation forced people to buy goods with hundreds, thousands, even millions of German marks. They lost faith in the system, and they looked for some new leader to provide solutions. The economic crisis also put great pressure on the international circle of debt that had been created after the war. Suddenly, American bankers could no longer make loans to Germany. This meant that Germany could not pay back war debts to France and the other Allied nations in the war to end all wars. And without this money, the Allied nations could not repay money that they owed American banks. The circle of debt fell apart.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The situation grew worse and worse throughout the early months of 1930. Hoover finally had to announce that all nations could delay their debt payments to the United States for 1 year. Hoover's actions did what he wanted it to, it put a temporary stop to the international debt crisis. But it caused great damage to private banks. People lost faith in the banking system. Throughout Europe, people withdrew their money from banks. As a result, the European banks could not repay more than $1 billion that they had borrowed from private American banks.
This was not the only problem. Nations throughout Europe were also forced to take their currencies off the gold standard. This meant their money no longer could be exchanged for gold. The economic situation grew worse, and as it did, serious political tensions began to threaten peace in Asia and Europe.
The threat in Asia became clear first. Japan had defeated Russia in a war in 1905. This victory gave Japan control over the economy of the southern part of what was then called Manchuria in northeastern China. As years passed, Japan began to feel threatened by two forces. First, Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek was trying to organize all of China under the control of his nationalist forces. Second, Russia was extending the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Japan's army took control of the government in Tokyo in late 1931. The army was fearful of the growing threat to Japan's control of Manchuria, so it moved Japanese troops immediately into several Manchurian cities, and it claimed political control of the whole area. President Hoover and most Americans strongly opposed Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to take any action that might lead to another world war.
Japan's military leaders knew that the people of Europe and America had no desire to fight to protect China. And so the Japanese army marched on. It invaded the huge city of Shanghai, killing thousands of civilians. Western leaders condemned the action. American Secretary of State Henry Stimson said the United States would not recognize Japanese control in these areas of China. But again, Hoover refused to consider any economic actions against the Japanese, and he strongly opposed taking any military action. The League of Nations also refused to recognize Japan's takeover. It called Japan the aggressor in Manchuria. Japan reacted simply. It withdrew from the League of Nations.
Most Americans were not happy about Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to fight force with force. This was less true, however, for Secretary of State Stimson. Stimson was a follower of the old ideas of President Theodore Roosevelt. He believed a nation could only have a strong foreign policy by being strong and using its military power in times of crisis. But Stimson's voice was in the minority. Most Americans did not believe Japan really threatened the security of the United States, and they were not ready to risk their lives to help people in China. Opinions changed only after Japanese planes attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, in December of 1941.
The same story was true in Europe. but France was worried about the rising power of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy and Spain. France proposed the creation of an international army. Hoover opposed that idea. He called for all nations to reduce their weapons. He believed that negotiation, not force, was the way to solve the problem. But the new leaders in Germany and Japan would listen much more closely to the footsteps of marching troops than to the high words of peace.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.